You're listening to episode 19 of Does Not Compute. This week, we're sponsored by Hired. Now, you may be asking yourself, what is this Hired thing I keep hearing about? Well, you're in luck because I'm going to give you all the details. Simply put, Hired makes it really easy for engineers and designers to find new jobs. After you signed up, preferably at hired.com/doesnotcompute, they'll get your information in front of over 3,000 awesome companies from all the places you chose across North America and Europe. These companies will then send you interview requests with salary and equity up front. You'll get 5 or more interview requests per week, and since they list numbers right away, it's really easy to figure out which ones you want to check out more. Once you find your next job, Hired gives you a $1,000 bonus to say thanks for using them. The cool part is, if you actually did sign up at hired.com/doesnotcompute, they'll give you a $2,000 bonus instead. It's totally free and totally risk-free, so check them out today. Dev Bootcamp is our second sponsor this week. They're an immersive software development program that takes place over the course of 19 weeks. Here's how it works. For the first 9 weeks, you'll be doing part-time remote work, about 15 to 25 hours per week, to learn the basics of HTML, CSS, Ruby, JavaScript, Git, and SQL. During that time, you'll be doing weekly challenges as well as pairing sessions with Dev Bootcamp staff members. After that, you'll go on site at one of their campus locations across the United States for the remainder of the program. Once on site, you'll continue to improve the language skills you've already learned while getting a lot of experience with pair programming and group projects. There are daily challenges and lectures to make sure you continue heading in the right direction. Week 19 is an optional week focused on career prep, where you'll get help preparing for interviews and figuring out how to find your first development job. Dev Bootcamp is currently accepting applications, so make sure to check them out at devbootcamp.com/doesnotcompute.
So, Paul, I've had something in my mind the past week that I'd like to talk to you about.
Well, that's good, because that's what our contract says we have to do. So, works for me.
And the thing is, Git. We've been talking a lot about JavaScript and Ruby and servers and how much we wish auto was a thing right now. But we haven't been talking much about Git, or I don't think we've ever really talked about it, honestly.
Yeah, as far as I can remember, we actually haven't talked about it ever, which is kind of strange. Because I know it's something that both of us use every single day a lot.
Yeah, I think most of our listeners use it every single day, all day long. And if not, you should familiarize yourself with Git, and I will throw some resources into the show notes. But more specifically, I've been thinking about, I guess, how organized I am with my workflow, with my Git workflow, between my commit messages, what I'm committing, when I'm committing them, how I'm using branches. And I guess what got me thinking about that was, you know, the team over at Octopus, we're growing a little bit, and we got some more developers, and we have a little crossover on some projects, right? So basically, I'm trying to rethink how I approach my version control.
So what does that mean for you? What kind of steps are you taking to change how that works?
Well, I guess the first thing is that most often what I do is I branch off of master and then anything goes. It's just like the Wild West in that branch. So I'm committing, I'm fixing different issues. And there have been times in the past where I'll make branches and I'll prefix that branch with like a GitHub issue number, with the title of the issue. But for the most part, when I'm trying to move quickly on something, I just have one branch called maybe develop or something like that, that I do a lot of work in, and then maybe I'll merge that into master. Maybe I'll push it up and make a merge request. I don't know. Basically, I don't really have a standard way of doing things at this point.
And kind of the goal is to get to a place where you do have a standardized way of doing those things.
Right, and maybe it doesn't have to be something rigid. It's just that, you know, if I'm coordinating with more freelancers, you know, they're taking on some work, and coordinating with the people that I work with every day that are also committing to the same projects, it might be nice to have some sort of protocol to follow. I guess that way it takes less mental overhead to see where a project's at, because right now some of my older work, I might go to it and there are a bunch of branches, and I don't even remember what they mean anymore. I guess that's okay, but you know, if I'm trying to catch up with one of my developers, I want to be able to check out Git, and there'd be some rhyme to reason, you know?
Right. I feel like being too strict with what you can and can't do in Git can be a bummer, especially when you're starting out in the very early days of a project. Like, if you're just getting started and it's not even close to an alpha yet, a lot of times you're going to be committing and removing a bunch of files, you're going to be changing structures all the time, and it's not going to necessarily be for a specific feature or bug, but you're just going to be doing stuff, right? The repo is constantly changing and growing and evolving in new ways, and you don't want to limit yourself too much. So for me personally, what I love to do is when it's just me at the very early stages of a project, I will oftentimes just work in master and make a bunch of commits there. Obviously, that doesn't scale well. So if you're working with other people, then you should be branching out and then merging in. But at the beginning, it's such a freeform process. Like, this sounds really pretentious, but development, especially in that way, is kind of an art, like making broad strokes and big changes. And I think constraining yourself too much at that phase of a project can make things turn out in sort of a rigid way, right?
Right. Well, it can make it feel rigid, which could, I guess, somehow impair inspiration. You know, if you're thinking about having to merge things or branch things a certain way or write your commit messages a certain way, it might distract you from a sudden moment of inspiration where you might have a breakthrough. I don't know. I feel the same way, especially when a project is really... I feel like projects go through phases, right? There's a phase where you're exploring and you're writing lots of code really quickly, and maybe there doesn't need to be a lot of structure there. And then there's the phase where the project grows up a little bit and you have some other contributors. And at that point, I feel like is when you need to start maybe synchronizing things, you know, so people aren't accidentally overwriting other people's changes, or, you know, some people, I guess that's what Git is for. You know, if someone's committing to the same branch, you know, solving that problem. But just having some sort of plan together so it feels more put together, if that makes sense.
Yeah, definitely. And I love the freeform stuff for the very, very early phases of a project. But then even if it continues to just be me on the project going forward, as soon as it's in any sort of stable, real state where it exists as a thing that works, I will always, always switch to GitHub Flow or something very similar to it, where everything gets entered into GitHub Issues or whatever issue tracking platform I'm using. Every single thing, feature, bug request, anything goes in there, and then everything becomes a branch, hopefully, ideally off of master. And then I work out of that branch, submit a pull request with rationalization and all that, and then get that pulled back in. That makes things so much clearer. And for me, it does feel like a little bit of extra work at first. Like when I was first starting to use Git, I never did this ever. It feels lighter weight, and it's like easier to get started with. But really, in the long term, it makes your Git history much less usable, I think, as a resource for you to go back and look at how things flowed.
Right. And I think what got me going on the subject was I would have to ask people I'm working with, hey, what have you been working on? As opposed to going to Git and looking at exactly what they've been working on, you know. But it's interesting to me that you mentioned GitHub Flow, because I like that method a lot. We use GitLab. And so what I like to do is just put a whole bunch of issues into GitLab at once, anything I can think of. And then what I'll do is what you said. I'll make a new branch for each issue. And then when that's done, I will submit a pull request. And then I'll basically merge all the code on GitLab. I don't drag anything into master on my local machine. But aside from that, I know that you've gone from working with a lot of kind of closed source things to more open source projects. How has how you approach using Git changed?
You know, I think I am a little bit more structured about it in general. A lot of that is because with the projects I'm working on right now, it is almost always more than one person working on it, if for no other reason than because it's open source and anybody could submit a PR at any point. So, of course, you want your master to stay very, very clean, and you want to have releases, tagged releases that can go into, for example, Bower or NPM, whatever package distribution method you're using. I think a really great thing about that, kind of a side advantage, is that it makes your project just look so much more polished, which for an open source project is kind of, I mean, that's your marketing, right? That's how you present what you're doing to the world, is through the commit history, the commit frequency, just what it looks like in general. Do you have a nice README even? So all of those things that for internal projects oftentimes fall by the wayside, for better or worse, in the open source world, when you're doing things more in public, it really does pay to have a very clean, very, very structured repository.
Right. When I see open source projects that have a nice README or they appear really organized, I generally feel that the quality of code is stronger. And that may or not be the case, but that's how it makes me feel.
Well, I think that's a really good signal, though. Because if you go to a GitHub project page, let's say you're looking for something for your new project. You're like, I need a new light box. And I know there's a million different light boxes out there. I'm going to go to Google or go to some listicle and open 20 of them in background tabs and then go through all those repos. Those are really good signals. So that's kind of the three things that I look at first to weed things out when I'm going through GitHub repos like that. I look, how many stars do they have? When was the most recent commit? And is the README good? Like, those three things will get you so, so far. And it sounds kind of silly. Like, who cares how many GitHub stars they have? But they, most repositories, generally speaking, have those stars for a reason.
Right. When you look at the stars, it's somewhat of an indicator of the number of people in the community or the community surrounding that project. And when you see more stars, you feel like more people are using this thing. Maybe it's been tested more, you know, but just a bigger community. When you see more recent commits, you're basically looking to see, is this thing dead? You know, because I've seen some tools that look pretty awesome that had really great READMEs. I'm like, wow, this is going to be really cool. And I look at the last commit and it's 3 years ago. And maybe that's still useful, but that doesn't make me feel very good about it.
Right. And sometimes that can be fine, because maybe that particular tool doesn't need to be updated that frequently, because some things do stay the same for a very long time. For example, I would say exception notification. Like, if you're working on error handling kind of stuff, that is typically not going to change all that much super frequently. So maybe it's fine if it hasn't had a commit in a year or two. Like I said, you shouldn't make all your decisions based just on those three things, but they are very great indicators. I think taken all three of them together are very good indicators of whether or not something is worth even looking at.
So just curious, but what kind of things do you look for in a README?
Well, it depends a bit on what the product is that I'm looking for. But in general, I would say an elevator pitch right up front is great. If you can't tell me what your thing does in, I don't know, 2 to 4 sentences, then that generally feels a little weird to me. I want a concise description, because that often means a concise API. Not always, but often means a concise API. I also really like to see examples, a simple example, slightly more complex example, couple different ways of using it with different tools, if it integrates with different tools, that sort of thing. And again, this is very dependent on what I'm looking for, like what the tool I need is. But in general, I just think examples and concise explanations are a great, great start for pretty much any repository.
Yeah, I think you pretty much nailed it there. Those are the things that I almost always look for as well. I mean, especially the examples. I don't know if it's just me, but I tend to always scroll towards the examples first. I guess that's because it gives me a feeling of the API, how it was built, you know, how I might use it. Or most of the time, I'm Googling for something to solve a specific problem that I'm facing right then. And so I'll scroll right to examples to see if this might actually even be viable.
Right. And I think the big thing about examples for me is, we've talked about this so often, read the code. Read the code to see if things are good. Read the code to see if things make sense. Read the code to learn. And examples are code. Like, it's not the source code of the project, but it gives you a good idea of the philosophy just right up front, without having to really think about it or do too much work, without having to do a deep dive on the source code, which of course I still recommend doing. But it's such a good first indicator of whether or not something is going to be terrible or great to work with.
Sure. And I guess one last thing on the subject is another question I have for you. You know, me being someone that doesn't do a whole lot of open source work, most of my open source contributions have been like spelling fixes or grammar fixes or documentation fixes for a few different open source libraries that I use. But as an open source project maintainer, what sort of things are you looking for? What sort of thing would be really useful for you if someone out there that's listening wants to get involved in open source, wants to get their foot in that door? What's something that would be really useful for you?
So I think the best pull requests, the best bug reports, the best everything comes from people who are actually using these libraries. Let's say you're a big fan of, I don't know, jQuery. That's awesome, and it probably means that you use it a lot and you understand how it should work. So that's going to make it very easy for you to spot bugs if they do exist. Now, once you have that information, because you're actually a consumer of that product, then you will be very capable of writing a good bug report, which is a great first step. A lot of times when I want to contribute to an open source library, what I'll actually do is I'll just pick something that I use where I've seen some inconsistency or some weirdness or a feature I would like added, and I'll write out a very, very detailed report of what the thing I'm looking for is, why I think it's useful, an idea of how it might be implemented, submit that as a new issue, but then say, if you would like, I'm happy to do this. I just wanted to see if you had any thoughts on the implementation. That's worked great for me in the past, and I think it's an awesome way to do it. Of course, you can also just submit a PR if that's more your style, but that won't necessarily get accepted. And I think it's nice to kind of kick that conversation off in more of a neutral way without actually writing code first. Because you don't want to waste any effort, of course.
Of course. I think one of the most important things you mentioned there was planning and documentation. Writing down what your goal for your pull request would be and why, more importantly, why you're doing it, right? I've seen a lot of pull requests because I browse the issues a ton, right? And I've seen a lot of pull requests opened where people say something like, I did this thing and that was it. And the author almost always responds with, well, why did you do this? What specific problem does this solve for you? Or, you know, why did you take this approach? And you can almost skip that step by providing the documentation up front. So then you're more clear to the author. The author doesn't have to take that time because most open source maintainers are pretty busy, right? Open source takes a lot of work if you're maintaining something. And you basically remove the requirement that they have to respond to you in that manner or asking for more details, right?
So that's actually sort of similar to the XY problem, which I think is a fairly well-known thing. DeveloperT actually has a great episode on it from last year. We'll have a link to that in show notes. But basically what that means is if you just ask a question without explaining what you're trying to do, if you just say, this thing doesn't work, but you don't say, because I'm trying to use it for this, oftentimes the problem isn't that that thing doesn't work. The problem is that you're trying to use it for something that it's not supposed to work. If you have a problem and something isn't working that way, explaining what you're trying to do with it and what your goal is, someone will often have a better solution, which not only eliminates the entire bug that you thought you had, but also gives you a much cleaner way to do it. So I think that's a really great way because nobody in the world is going to understand that code base better than the person who maintains it, the primary maintainer or maintainers. That core group of people, they're going to have so much knowledge about why those internals work that way, even if it doesn't seem like it. Like, you're like, this is a very simple thing. This should be so easy. They have dealt with all the problems. That's why they wrote this in the first place. So explaining not only what you want to do, but why you want to do it and what your goals are is so, so helpful. And this isn't just if you're new to open source. I think this is great advice for anybody. This is something that just generally speaking, even for internal stuff at your own company, explaining things out and really writing them out with examples and descriptions, kind of like what I look for in a README, actually makes your issues so much more useful to the maintainers, but it also helps you figure out the problems in your own head, which I think is great.
That's a really great point, and that's something that I've been actively practicing. There's also another DeveloperT episode where he talks about when you hit an issue, instead of directly going to Stack Overflow or typing it into Google, he says take 15 minutes and think about it before you look for an answer in an external place. And that does a few things for you. Number one, it forces you to be able to spot causes faster. So if you're constantly Googling for answers and you're just copying and pasting a lot of code, you're not really understanding or internalizing what's happening and what's causing it to break. And number two, you're not really internalizing the fix for that, right? So then you kind of get into a pattern of Google and paste until it works, which ends up wasting a lot of time. So 15 minutes sounds like quite a while for you just to sit and ponder about something. But once you begin to understand how to think about solving these problems or how to isolate a cause for a problem, you end up saving so much more time.
Yeah, and that amount of time, that 15 minutes, maybe it'll take 15 minutes every single time at first. But as you practice that skill and as you hone those brain muscles, as it were, maybe it'll take 10 minutes for a lot of problems, and then maybe it'll take 5 minutes for a lot of those problems. And you can condense that down by practicing it, just like with anything. And I think another small benefit is that it's kind of like with a puzzle game, like a puzzle video game. Anytime you have that thing, if you look it up on the internet, it's significantly less satisfying to get that answer that way. You feel so great after you figure something out on your own. And of course, don't spin your wheels for too long. That's what makes the 15-minute cap so great, where it gives you a chance to think, get up, grab, you know, a cup of coffee, and think about things, walk around a little bit. That'll kind of jog your brain and make things click. A lot of the time, though, at the very least, you might come up with better Google search terms, which will help you find the answer faster.
I think what you said about the 15-minute cap being good and then after 15 minutes, go ask for help is huge, because I'm very good at spinning my wheels. As you know, I'm very good at getting stuck. Getting stuck in a loop, right? Going in circles and never actually coming out of that loop. So putting a limit on that is great for me, because then it forces me to say, hey, I've exhausted all of my knowledge on this, and now I need to go find out.
Yeah, and I seriously mean a hard cap on that 15 minutes. Like, set a timer. And then when that timer goes off, you start typing in Google. Start typing in Google. We all know that's what you're going to do.
So earlier today, Andrew Ho on Twitter reached out and asked if we would talk about deployment and anything surrounded that, whether it's Docker, AWS, DigitalOcean, Heroku. He just wants to know what's out there.
Yeah, and this is obviously an incredibly, incredibly broad topic. Like, there are so many options, and even within any given option, there are so many sub-options and different ways of handling everything. So I figured it would probably just make sense to kind of give an overview of the tools that we've worked with in the past and what we've really liked and disliked about those.
That sounds like a good plan. Most recently, I've been using Daku to deploy a Rails app. And if you've never heard of Daku, it is very similar to Heroku. In fact, it uses Heroku build packs behind the scenes. And essentially what you do is you install Daku on a server and you add the app on the server. And then it gives you a Git remote that you add to your local project. And then you can Git push to that remote and it uploads all your changes for you. And it runs any migrations you might need. It might run any asset compilation that needs to happen. So it basically is like a little personal Heroku server.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting option. I haven't used Daku personally. Have there been any hiccups with that or roadblocks?
It's been working pretty okay so far. Granted, I haven't used it extensively. I'm only serving one Rails app from this install. But anytime I have a DevOps question, I hit up a friend of the show, Daniel McMahon from Slash Rocket, and ask him. And he said, don't even bother setting it up yourself. Just use the DigitalOcean one-click installer. And that's what I did. And it worked fine.
So you're running Daku on DigitalOcean, right?
Correct.
Interesting. What size droplet is that?
2 gigabytes, because I found that the 1 gigabyte droplet, which would be the minimum required setup for Daku, was running a bit slow.
So it sounds like there might be a little bit of overhead, but that's not terrible.
If you consider that all you have to do is Git push to this thing and you can have multiple apps running multiple environments on your server, it's pretty okay.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, the Heroku I feel like the Heroku setup, the Heroku way, as it were, is pretty solid in general. It generally makes for a nice developer experience, I think.
Right. So another way I've deployed apps is with Heroku, and I used Heroku at the end of this last week, and it was great. So I used to use them previously, and they were a lot more expensive, but now they added the hobby dev plan for almost all their services, which is great. So I can run some pretty beefed up staging servers for clients for $16 a month.
Yeah, it's Heroku, I feel like in the last maybe half year or so, has really, really stepped up their game, especially with their web interface. So before, their web interface was good, but it was a little bit clunky. And now it is just so completely streamlined. And they have the more clear pricing, and they have their own Redis now, which is amazing. I love it. For a while, I was kind of iffy on Heroku, but they have made such major strides. It makes it ridiculously easy to deploy an app that actually does scale pretty well and is just very simple to get up and running with. What's interesting is the typical Heroku flow is that you would add them as another remote to your Git repo and then push to that remote. But they actually have a different setup where you can connect it to GitHub and have it automatically deploy every time you push to a certain branch on GitHub. So I'm using that for a side project I'm working on right now, and it's been pretty great. Like, all I have to do is push to the staging branch, and that part automatically deploys. And it's awesome. I don't even have to think about it.
Right. It's pretty great just to be able to push to a branch and know that whatever app you're working on has been updated. I mean, granted, you have to run things like, you know, DB Migrator stuff yourself, but it still is really painless, which I think is awesome. Another way that I've deployed things in the past is with Capistrano. And what I have to say about Capistrano is that it works.
I feel like if you want to have your own completely customized deploy environment, if you want to make sure you are running on the leanest possible hardware for the cheapest possible price, and you have people who understand this stuff on your team, understand it very deeply and intimately, like more than just enough to get it working, but enough to actually maintain those servers on a long-term basis and figure out what's going on when things do inevitably blow up, then something like Capistrano can be a great solution. It's very good once it's working, and it is significantly cheaper overall than running on any of these other services. Running on your own architecture is great. That's the dream, but it's also a lot of work. So it can be an awesome fit, I think, for certain types of team. But in general, a lot of the people who are in very early stage startups or working just on side projects, it's overkill. And I'm saying that as someone who has done a lot of Capistrano deploys.
Right. I think the most complicated Capistrano deploy I've ever worked on was split between five different servers, right? It had a load balancer, it had two web app servers, it had a database server and Elasticsearch server. And Capistrano would handle updating all that stuff. But while I was working on that, it took me a while to set it up because I'm not a DevOps guy. Like, I can make it work, but it took me a while to set it up. Whereas something like, I mean, Daku was not that much work because I used a one-click installer, but from what I read, if you have to install it yourself, it can be a lot of work. And then if you compare that against Heroku, where if you're willing to, you know, put, I guess, less than $20 a month, you have your stuff ready to go right there.
Right. I feel like the big concern with something like Heroku or even AWS to an extent is scaling. Like, they make it very easy to scale because you just drag the thing and it theoretically, at least, scales. But in the real world, if you hit major, major success, it becomes a gigantic risk to move away from it. So in many cases, it is a bit of a gamble to go with these services. But I think for the vast majority of what we're doing, I mean, you're doing client work for, I don't want to say tiny projects, but for smaller companies in general, who are probably never going to outgrow that. They're not going to be Facebook or Instagram or something along those lines, or even Snapchat, right? But Heroku does give them a lot of the same architecture benefits without that fear of having to have somebody on staff, on call all the time, who knows and understands servers deeply.
Well, it's even nice to be able to say to clients, because I've had people ask me, like, what happens if something like Heartbleed happens again, you know? Being able to say, like, well, if you're on Heroku or if you're on another Heroku-like service, that'll be patched for you. You don't have to worry about it, right? Versus if you're running your own deploy via Capistrano or via Daku or Docker or whatever you're using, you're going to have to patch that server yourself. And it's just, for me, it's one more thing to think about. It's one more thing to remember, which for me, Heroku is honestly worth a little bit extra money to not have to worry about that and not have to think about that. So, I mean, for most of what we've talked about, it's been more Rails-based deployments. So if you're deploying something like Node or heck, even a Go app, Heroku can do that as well. Daku can do that as well. If you're just doing maybe a JavaScript application, something I've come across recently, which I think is really great, is called search.sh. And they only serve static sites. So what you do is you install an NPM module and you just type search and it gives you a subdomain and your site is on it. And it's fast and they provide free SSL. They provide push state support and all that right out of the gate. And if you want some other things, you can pay for it, but it works really great.
Huh, that's cool. I hadn't heard about that. I think another good option for purely static sites can be S3 because it's very easy to put behind some sort of CDN for really great edge support. And it just is extraordinarily cheap and scales without you having to do anything at all. They just bill you for whatever your bandwidth is, and you're done. Does Not Compute was sponsored by Dev Bootcamp, which helps new developers learn many of the languages and skills we talk about on the show. They provide challenges and a curriculum modeled after real software development projects to help students get ready for finding their first software development job. Head to devbootcamp.com/doesnotcompute to learn more and apply. We'd also like to give a big thank you to our second sponsor, Hired. Hired makes it so much easier for designers and developers to find new jobs. After you've signed up, interview requests will come to you. And when you find an amazing new job, Hired gives you a $1,000 thank you bonus. It removes all the headache for you, and it's entirely free. Sign up at hired.com/doesnotcompute to get a double thank you bonus of $2,000 instead. And finally, the biggest thank you to you for listening. If you're enjoying the show, please stop by the Spec Slack and say hi. Both Sean and I love talking to listeners and hearing their thoughts, and it's really easy to sign up. Just head to spec.fm/slack. Actually want to record this episode?
We probably should. We have a contract with Sarah, you know.